weather brings.
Hi, this is Jim Meacham calling from Auckland, New Zealand, way down under. You're listening to Weather Brains.
And this time on Weather Brains, is there too much hype in the weather business?
Extremely dangerous heat, and we all could die.
You know, it's always hot.
A look at the consequences of crying wolf, and how relevant is some of the news the media feeds us these days?
With a 24-hour news cycle now, the networks are just forced to, in many cases, just go for the easiest thing that they can make a big fuss out of.
Also this time,
let's say, you know, somebody comes out and says, okay, we're looking for a W4 or a W5.
A proposal to assign ratings to El Niños and La Niñas. Good idea or confusing? Plus, you better hope for a clear sky this weekend.
You want to stay up late.
And find a dark spot away from city lights. We'll explain. We also talk about some weather people making the news. And what part of the country has seen 531 flash flood warnings January through July of this year? We'll tell you where. Plus, you'll get a worldwide perspective on hurricanes, courtesy of Professor Peters and Weather Brains 101. Also, weather's role in two disastrous bridge failures in 1904 and 1997. Bill Murray has more on that with This Week in Weather History, and he'll bring us the story of what a meteorologist discovered this week back in 1968. It had a profound effect on our understanding of thunderstorms. It's all coming up. It's episode number 80 of Weather Brains, the show that's all about weather, produced by The Weather Company. Hello, I'm David Black. With me for this ride is James Spann, Kevin Selly, and Brian Peters. Mr. Peters, are you staying out of trouble?
No, absolutely not.
I thought I'd give you the chance, but, you know, what are you into now?
I'm stealing Wi-Fi on Mount Cheehaw, so.
James Spann, you heard him say it.
You know, at least now he's becoming open and honest about his problems. So that's the first way of getting help, is just being open and honest. So that's a good thing.
Wi-Fi thief Brian Peters. Somebody who's not known as a Wi-Fi thief is Kevin Selly, coming to us from Dallas, Texas. How are you, Mr. Selly? And you're not stealing Wi-Fi, are you?
No, and we're actually finally enjoying some actual summertime in North Texas with temperatures in the upper 90s and lots of sunshine and no rain, which is very uncharacteristic for this summer.
Do folks in Texas enjoy upper 90s?
Enjoy being a relative term. We certainly expect it, I guess. Hey, you know what I've got, though? Can I share this with you early on? You know, JB usually handles all the numbers and statistics. Can I share an interesting statistic that I got today? It's really an amazing one.
Lay it on us.
Gary Woodall, who is the warning coordination meteorologist for National Weather Service Fort Worth, who has been on this program before, but he went back and he was doing some stats research and came up with some really amazing numbers, and I'll only share one just because it is amazing. But he went back and he looked at tornado and flash flood and severe thunderstorm warnings issued out of Fort Worth during the January through July time period. So in 2006, and we're talking about flash flood warnings here, 2006 there were 98 flash flood warnings issued by that office. This year, and everybody's heard about all the rain and all the flooding across Texas, but just in north central Texas, in comparison to 98 last year, this year during that time frame, 531 flash flood warnings issued by that office.
Holy
cow. Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
And there's been a lot of damage and loss of life because of it, too.
Yeah, that's true, and a lot of that is in central and southwest Texas. So those are my stats for the day.
Yeah, and I am interested in flash flooding because that is a seemingly not particularly exciting type of weather, yet it kills people all the time. People, they just don't take that threat seriously in a lot of cases.
That's very true.
And the last time I looked at the statistics, David, about 75% of all deaths in flash floods were related to automobiles.
Yeah, people just, they don't seem to be getting the lesson in a lot of cases, and that's a tragic reality that I hope maybe will change with time. Speaking of tragedies, we've sure had some in the news lately, but weather could play a role in efforts to get the Interstate 35 West Bridge replaced in Minneapolis. That's because of an extremely ambitious rebuilding schedule that state authorities are working on. Building a new bridge like the one that collapsed into the Mississippi River August 1st would normally take around 3 years. Now, instead, check this. The state is working on a plan to have a new bridge open and running for traffic by the end of next year. Now, that would be a tough job to do, they say, but it's doable. But one of the biggest challenges to this fast-track plan could be the weather. Minnesota, of course, is no stranger to ultra-harsh winters. Authorities say if the Mississippi River freezes, barges may not be able to move around, and that could throw a real wrench into plans to get that interstate back together. The federal government has already committed $250 million to rebuild the bridge, but some estimates put the replacement cost at around $300 million to $350 million. Now, the state will probably create some financial incentives to provide for even more money. That's if the contractors manage to finish ahead of schedule. In the meantime, five people are confirmed dead in the Minnesota collapse, but at least eight more people were reported missing. Even now, as authorities continue to try to retrieve twisted piles of wreckage and possible victims from the river, state authorities were putting the word out that contractors interested in bidding on the rush job had, get this, only 3 days to get in touch with them. The plan to give incentives for faster completion has worked with Interstate 10 bridges over Escambia Bay, Florida. Those bridges were damaged in 2004 by Hurricane Ivan. Traffic there started moving in December. So maybe that will get them back up and running a little bit quicker if they kick in some more money, and it seems to have worked post-Ivan. And there's still plenty of hurricane damage you can see down along the Gulf Coast to the roads and other infrastructure. Right, Brian? Yep. You've been down there.
Yes, and I know how to solve the towboats in the ice problem.
Oh?
Can we get an icebreaker up there?
Yeah, you would think so, but, you know, there may be other logistical issues with that. But that's really a mammoth job that those people have to deal with to try to, you know, just think about all the engineering and the planning and the design and just all the considerations, not to mention the expense and the hassle that people are going to have to go through up there. Well, if you enjoy the outdoors, this weekend might be a good one to go camping and to stay up late Sunday night, August 12th. Brian Peters might do this. Span, I don't think so, because he's always working early on Monday mornings. The annual Perseid meteor shower promises an opportunity to see traces of ancient history zipping across the sky. Bill Cook is head of the Meteoroid Environments Office for NASA at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. He knows all about the Perseids.
This weekend is the annual Perseid meteor shower, which is the second best one out of the year. The only one that's better are the Geminids in mid-December, but since summer nights are nice and warm, most people like going out and observe Perseids rather than freezing in the middle of winter.
So what kind of a display are we potentially in store for?
Well, you can see if you're out in a good dark sky on the night of August 12th, and the early morning of August 13, you should see anywhere from 1 to 2 Perseids per hour, 1 to 2 Perseids per minute, excuse me, after midnight. So you want to stay up late. And the peak of this year's shower will occur somewhere around midnight Eastern time on August 13th. That's the night of August 12th.
What part of the sky do we need to be looking in?
Look straight up. Best way to observe meteors is to spread out a blanket or a sleeping bag or a lawn chair, lie flat on your back, and just look straight up with your two eyes and take in as much of the sky as possible.
So this is the weekend to go camping.
Amen. It's going to be a good time to go out and observe meteors. The sky will be putting on its best annual fireworks display tonight, at least for those of us who like warm weather.
So where do these meteors originate anyway? What's their history?
The Perseids are relics from a comet called Swift Tuttle, and this comet was discovered back around the time of the Civil War. It takes over 100 years to go around the sun once, and the stuff you'll see burning up in Earth's atmosphere is probably thousands of years old. So when you see a Perseid, you're seeing a piece of ice from a comet that's burning up after being out in space for a very long time.
When we see one that's particularly bright, really brilliant, on average, how large of a piece are we really seeing?
Well, most Perseids you see are about a millimeter across. The really bright ones are about half an inch to an inch across. So when you think of a Perseid, you pull out a ruler and look at that 1 millimeter, and that's how bright the typical, how big the typical Perseid is.
So it doesn't take much mass. It puts on one heck of a show.
Yeah, when you're moving at 40 miles per second, it doesn't take much mass to burn up.
So this might be a good chance to try some photography skills, too.
It would be. Time exposures of the Perseids are an excellent idea.
Your office monitors meteor impacts on the moon, is that right?
That's one of the things we do, yes.
Why is that important?
Well, if you're going back to the moon and you're going to stay for months at a time, you'd like to know what the chances of getting hit in the head with a rock are.
Okay.
There's no atmosphere on the moon. You can go out and absorb the Perseid meteor shower without worrying about getting bonked on the head, okay, because they burn up in the atmosphere 50, 60 miles up. The moon has no air, so all these rocks come crashing down on the surface. So what to us looks like a wonderful sky show, to an astronaut on the moon, maybe an opportunity to take cover.
So better to do the camping on Earth and on the lunar surface for this weekend.
Yes, but even on the lunar surface, the rate is so low that you won't have to really worry about it. The odds of being hit are small, but you don't want to take any chances, especially since you're in a spacesuit, you know?
Gotcha. What other things does your office do besides?
Well, we forecast meteor shower activity, and we generate models of the meteor environment throughout the solar system, and we monitor meteors by radar, all sorts of stuff. Anything we having to do with meteors and meteoroids, we do it.
Meteors are us.
Meteors are us.
All right. Mr. Cook, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
You're more than welcome.
That's Bill Cook with NASA's Meteoroid Environments Office at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. All right, Brian, if you're going to go to the moon, take your football helmet, because you just heard what he said. Could bonk you on the head.
Well, I think I'll still be at Cheeha next Sunday evening, so I'll have to sleep in late in the morning and stay up late in the evening and report back on the next Weather Brains as to what the meteor shower was like.
Yeah, and for folks who do not know what Cheeha is, if they missed a previous Weather Brains netcast or two, that's Mount Cheeha State Park on the Alabama-Georgia line, a beautiful place to be, and where if you were right there right now, you'd probably see this guy with his notebook computer in the camping scene. Is there anything kind of unusual about that setting to you, James or Kevin?
You know, he's out there with that big old Pringles can Wi-Fi antenna he's got to steal Wi-Fi. That's the one way you can spot mine.
And stargazing and doing
sure.
Who knows what else.
And he's the one guy out there with Bermuda shorts, black socks, and dress shoes.
I need to set the record straight. I am in Bermuda shorts.
Oh,
it is rather hazy, and it was very difficult to even see the sun as it set while I was lounging in the pool. But I'm not wearing black socks.
Oh, man.
So you were in the pool with your Bermuda shorts?
Yeah.
No, I was in my bathing suit.
Okay. You know, we're getting into visuals I don't want to have.
We're in a bad rat hole here.
I don't want the visual of Brian Peters in a bathing suit or whatever.
Maybe we should talk about people on the move.
Well, we could do that. There are some people on the move in weather and in the news in general. Let's check in first with Mr. Peters for that.
Hey, David, some of the folks that we've interviewed in the past are moving along. I'd like to bring you up to date for Max Mayfield. The Partnership for Public Service recently announced that Max, the retired National Hurricane Center director, is a contender for the prestigious Service to America Medal, including the Federal Employee of the Year Award given annually to one of our nation's unsung heroes. Max, along with 30 other outstanding federal employees, was recently named a finalist for the Service to America Medals, or called the SAMMEs. The SAMMEs honor civil servants who have made innovative and high-impact contributions critical to the well-being of our nation. The winners will be honored on September the 19th at a Washington, D.C. gala. Also, Dan McCarthy, the WCM, or Warning Coordination Meteorologist, at the Storm Prediction Center, has accepted the meteorologist-in-charge position at the National Weather Service Forecast Office in Indianapolis, Indiana. A native of Cleveland, Ohio, Dan received his bachelor and master's in meteorology from St. Louis University and started his career as a meteorologist in the private sector. He worked for Great Lakes Weather in Wisconsin, WSAW-TV in Wausau, Wisconsin, and Weather Data Incorporated in Wichita, Kansas, before joining the National Weather Service Severe Storms Forecast Center, then in Kansas City, now called SPC. Dan has held several positions in that National Center, and he's co-authored several publications. So congratulations to some of our previous interviewees on WeatherBrains. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Mr. Peter. Somebody else in the news, with a final decision about his professional fate expected at any time, ousted National Hurricane Center Director Bill Proenza has filed a last-minute appeal demanding an immediate return to the job he lost July 9th. In a lengthy letter to NOAA Administrator Conrad Lautenbacher Jr., lawyers for Proenza say their client was the victim of retaliation by Lautenbacher because he was critical of his superiors in Washington. Proenza's lawyers also say an unflattering report by a team Lautenbacher assembled was inaccurate, unsubstantiated, and incomplete. Within days, nearly half of Proenza's staff, including many forecasters, issued a petition demanding his ouster. They said he had misrepresented their views and created a hostile work environment, assertions that were repeated by the investigative team. Proenza has been on indefinite leave of absence since his removal from NHC. The lawyer's appeal maintains that Proenza should be shielded by federal laws protecting whistleblowers because he had criticized NOAA managers for allegedly squandering money on a public relations campaign while hurricane researchers and forecasters dealt with budget shortfalls. The 62-year-old Proenza has more than 40 years of government service as a meteorologist and manager. So those are some people on the move in weather and in the news. Time now for the Weather Roundtable, where we just talk about what is on our mind in the world of weather. Mr. Spann, what's on your genius brain? What's cranking through the cells right now?
Well, I have growing concern, and maybe it's just a function of being old, I don't know, that in the weather business, there is way too much hyperbole, hype, if you will, when it comes to certain types of weather where that hype really doesn't need to be there. And what's really on my mind, it is now hot over a pretty good chunk of the country. This is early August, and all across the deep south, parts of the plains, the Midwest. This is the hottest week of the whole summer, and it just seems like not only do some weather people, but news organizations, the Weather Service, we are all guilty of this big hype machine talking about how this is extremely dangerous heat, and we all could die. And, you know, it's always hot, and it's, you know, I guess even locally, my station led with weather this evening on the 6 o'clock news. It will lead with weather tonight on the 10 o'clock news, and if you look at history, David, this heat doesn't compare with some of the really dangerous heat waves we've had. In the most recent that many people might recall, 1980. Other years would be 1952. You can even go back to 1898. But my question is, why do we have to hype everything that comes along? Because when we really do have a super dangerous heat wave like 1980, nobody's going to listen. And I think we're that way with thunderstorms. We're that way when it gets cold in the winter. I have great concern that we are getting a little too, I don't know, the cry wolf thing with this stuff. So, and you know, I saw a debate today on these heat advisories. I don't even know what that means. You know, some offices apparently have different criteria than other offices, and I know Joe Q Public doesn't know what it means either. So I hope that as all of us in this science, we can look at scaling back the hype and the dangerous verbiage in these forecasts for heat waves and cold snaps and thunderstorms that are marginally dangerous. So that's my rant of the day.
Don't you guys think that anytime you have a lack of consistency in the criteria for certain designations, weather terms, that just creates confusion for the public?
Yeah, and I'll be honest. I don't even know how many advisories we have. We used to have something called an air stagnation advisory. I don't even know if that's still around. But you got heat. What is it, Brian? Heat advisory? I don't even know.
Heat advisory.
I don't know. I just think we've got way too much stuff out there. And, Brian, does every office have a different definition or criteria for putting out one of those things?
Well, not exactly every office. Years ago, the National Weather Service decided that it was okay for some products, and I think heat advisory, and I'm not so sure about cold, but I know heat advisory was one of those that they said, coordinate with the state public health departments and come up with your criteria for your area. And of course, you know, I mean, For the southeastern U.S., 2 inches of snow is heavy snow. That's not true for Chicago or New York. So it made sense to have different advisory criteria. The problem I see right now is that Alabama's criteria is different from Georgia and Mississippi. We're surrounded by heat advisories right now, and yet I think Alabama's heat advisory, which was coordinated with the state public health department, is actually a better heat advisory situation because we're not issuing a heat advisory with this current situation. So
Kevin, let me ask you, in Texas, where it's in the upper 90s, are there heat advisories in effect out there?
No, they have some different criteria that are a little higher, and they tend to also look at the dew points and the humidity values and look for those heat index numbers before that kicks in, and that usually doesn't kick in Texas until
it's got to be 100 zillion degrees.
Yeah, well, it is. It's going to be maybe 104 to 105, and sometimes 106, depending upon I guess the region before it kicks in. But you know, as far as the journalism component of that, as sad as it is to say, I just think that cat's out of the bag and you're never going to get it back in. With a 24-hour news cycle now, operations and networks are just forced to, in many cases, just go for the easiest thing that they can make a big fuss out of in a short amount of time until the next thing comes along. You know, taking it away from weather for a minute, you know, we look at this terrible bridge tragedy last week in Minnesota, and I was thinking about this the other day, that there's been this big dust up, especially at the end of the week and over the weekend, about the bridges across the rest of the country. And it's obviously a big problem, and some people say 20% of the bridges are in trouble, and some people say 25% of the bridges are in trouble. But what's going to happen as far as the journalism outlets and the news outlets is, in the next couple of days, or maybe it's going to take a couple of weeks, they're going to lose interest in that, and some other thing is going to come along that's big and splashy and is easy to cover in a short amount of time and they can get all excited about, and a real problem like that is just going to fall by the wayside. But I think a lot of because of the news cycle,
it'll get swept under. And you know, I want to say something that ties directly to what you just said, Kevin. I was looking at ABC News' website last week on the 1st of August, and I don't know about you guys, but when you pull up some of these news sites and you see the banners that say breaking news, I've gotten to the point where there's a sick feeling in my stomach a lot because I think, oh no, has there been a terrorist attack again that I haven't heard about, or has there been a plane crash or some horrible event? But do you know what the breaking news was on the breaking news banner on their website on August 1st? I'm not making this up. I wrote this down.
Probably some bonehead stole a can of Dr. Pepper from a convenience store.
How about, and this is for real, Whoopi Goldberg introduced as new co-host of ABC's The View. That was their breaking news banner.
Please.
Oh. So, you know, all I can...
Sounds important to me.
Yeah.
I say that tongue in cheek.
All I can say is, Kevin, I'm 100% with you. You know, it's out of the bag, and it's, in my opinion, it's out of the control. But anyway.
I got one more rant, and I'll stop.
All right.
Another thing I noticed on most of these newscasts, like where they're leading with the hot weather now, they'll come on and say, these are tips that can save your life. And then they come on there and say, drink water, go into a cool building. I mean, you know, what idiot doesn't know this stuff? I mean, why is there even wasted space in a newscast for these things? It just, I don't get it. So with that, I'll shut up.
Well,
get in trouble.
It may have something to do with the fact that when you buy a package of ground beef in the grocery store, if you look at the labels, a lot of times they say things like, be sure to cook before you eat.
Don't eat raw meat.
Yeah, that's it. Anyway, Kev, what's on your mind in the Weather Brains Roundtable?
Well, maybe I'll just get James all whipped up again, because I was going to ask about this. Have you guys heard about the new rating system for El Nino and La Nina? This has been pitched by some folks at the CPC, the Climate Prediction Center, and they're kind of thinking that maybe El Nino and La Nina needs some sort of a scale like we have for tornadoes and for hurricanes. And so they're pitching the ENSO intensity scales, and similar to the other scales that we have, we go from W1 to W5 for warm episodes and C1 to C5 for cool episodes. But, you know, given our discussion of a moment ago, wow, what's going to happen? I mean, because some of these ratings will come out a couple of months before expected conditions would worsen or whatever was expected would come up. And so let's say, you know, somebody comes out and says, okay, we're looking for a W-4 or a W-5. How quickly is the media in general?
Breaking news.
Yeah, breaking news. We got a W-5. And then how long does that go for a couple of months out? So that'll really be interesting. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Does it need a scale or does it not?
Well, are there going to be W-4 advisories issued to the public?
Yes, there are advisories, and I'm trying to find what there are watches and advisories. Oh, a watch man. Would be, oh, you know, conditions are getting right for the, what do they say, potential development of an El Nino within 3 to 6 months. So that would be a watch. Okay. And then an advisory would mean conditions of El Nino or La Nina were underway.
So if there's a warning, you need to take cover immediately.
For every El Nino cycle, the impacts are different.
Right.
You know, people are going to try and read into some, you know, El Nino warning that, well, goodness gracious, that means that we're going to have these horrible tornadoes, we're going to have this horrible snowstorm or a drought, and every cycle is different. And yeah. I don't, you know, internally, I think it would be a good idea if we could keep it, you know, between us girls, but if that's going to be a public product, I wonder if it's of value, if it's going to create mass confusion and chaos out there, more FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
I'll go along with that. I don't think
I'm going to the grocery store and get milk and bread now
for 3 months.
Run quickly.
The interesting part is interesting because it says, you know, this would, one of the points they make is that it would allow climate researchers to develop comparisons with the past events, which I guess I can argue that, and that falls within James's comment of keeping it within the family and not making a big deal of it. But you know, as soon as there's a W-4 or a W-5 issue, that there are going to be reporters, you know, stacked up all along the California beach, the coastlines, just waiting for something to happen.
I can see it now. I don't think we need it. We need more terms just to confuse the dickens out of us. Like, we don't have enough confusion right now.
They just want to say this is tentative. It's not guaranteed yet. It's been pitched by CPC, and if it passes, it will begin sometime this fall. So we'll let you know.
What's on your mind, Brian?
Well, my rant may go against Mr. Spann a little bit. We are in one of the hottest weeks I think we've had in central Alabama. I know that the central part of the country has been rather hot already, but I just wanted to point out that heat and cold are two elements of weather that we don't give a lot of lip service to, and yet summers like the summer of 80, when I don't know what the number was, but I know it was something over 1,200 or so fatalities or deaths caused by the heat. And I just think it's one of those things that kind of sneaks up on us. And so I just wanted to put in a plug for, you know, people being conscious of all those things, like drinking water, that you should do when it gets hot. But I think all that's common sense. I don't think I need to be telling people the safety rules. But and I'm all for an ENSO scale. It'd be great. But I don't think the public needs to have that. I mean, to put it out there for people who are interested seems kind of crazy, doesn't it?
Well, I don't think that many people really latch on to the EF scale. And I know that it's a very valuable tool for research and for surveying, but I don't really see the value of it in the public real world, if that makes any sense. That's my opinion.
I got to agree with you on that, David. I think I understand the logic behind it, and we've talked about it at length, especially with Brian on this program, but my concern was that it just created too much confusion. I already feel like I've seen within the community, the journalism community, the anchor people who read those stories or the reporters, you know, they say the EF scale and they don't have the vaguest idea what the change is or what the difference is. I think that might have been, in my opinion, a bit of a mistake to just confuse people after so many years.
I hear you.
Well, even on our own station, James Spann and my station, we reported the wrong EF scale for a tornado that occurred in Enterprise on March 1st. So it is confusing.
Those things happen.
Yeah.
Let's check the Weather Brains email bag. We've had several emails this week. Want to say thanks to Alice Kottmeyer, who's an amateur radio operator, by the way, AB6WK, contacting us from Laurel, Maryland. We've had a lot of amateur radio operators contact us lately. We sure appreciate that. Joe Chance also contacted us. We heard from Nathan Rodriguez in Salt Lake City, Utah. Anita in Victor, New York. Hello. And another ham, Kevin Pauly, KB9WVI from Bloomington, Indiana. Hello, and thanks to all of those folks for saying hey. They happen in oceans all around the world and have several different names. What am I talking about? Yeah, you can probably figure it out. We get a look at hurricanes, courtesy of Professor Peters, who brings us this edition of Weather Brains 101. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray looks back at two incidents showing the incredible power of flash flooding. This Week in 1968 produced a discovery that revolutionized our understanding of thunderstorms. And folks in Florida remember Friday the 13th, this week in 2004, being unlucky because of Charlie. It's all part of the Weather Brains Weather Center.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
Each year, hundreds of low-pressure centers spin up over warm waters with weak contrasts in temperature in the tropics and subtropics, entering the life cycle of tropical storms. Tropical cyclones are characterized and driven by the release of large amounts of latent heat of condensation, which occurs when moist air is carried upwards and its water vapor condenses. This heat is distributed vertically around the center of the storm. So at any given altitude, except of course close to the surface where water temperature dictates air temperature, the environment inside the cyclone is warmer than its outer surroundings. When these systems organize to the point where their sustained winds top 34 knots or 39 miles an hour, they're known as tropical cyclones. But various parts of the world use a variety of terms once a tropical cyclone packs winds of at least 65 knots or 74 miles an hour. Around North and Central America, they're called hurricanes. The god of evil for the Carib people was named Hurrican, according to the authors of Hurricane Strike. That's the source, with a slight twist in spelling, of the name used in the Atlantic Ocean, Caribbean Sea, Gulf of Mexico, and the Northeast Pacific Ocean. In the Northwest Pacific, those same powerful storms are called typhoons. In the Southeastern Indian and Southwest Pacific Oceans, they're called severe tropical cyclones. In the North Indian Ocean, they're called severe cyclonic storms, while in the Southwest Indian Ocean, they simply keep the name tropical cyclone. The South Atlantic has been considered free of tropical cyclones, that is, until March 2004, when a mysterious storm later dubbed Hurricane Catarina made landfall in Brazil. Hurricanes that make Category 3 status on the Saffir-Simpson scale, that is, winds of at least 96 knots or 111 miles an hour, are labeled intense hurricanes. If a typhoon hits 132 knots or 150 miles an hour, it becomes a super typhoon. And just like names, hurricane seasons vary around the world. In the Atlantic Basin, including the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, the season runs from June 1st through November 30th, with most activity clustered from August to October. Well, that's Weather Brains 101 for this edition. Remember, if you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Let's look back at some interesting weather history for the week of August 7th through the 13th. It was on August 7th, 1904, that a railway bridge near Pueblo, Colorado, gave way after being weakened by a flash flood. A passenger train crossing over the bridge was swept into the torrent and 89 people perished. Now, 93 years later, on August 9th in 1997, a similar event, a little less tragic. Flash flooding on the Arizona desert weakened a bridge over a normally dry stream bed, caused the track to buckle and derailed the Southwest Chief Amtrak's passenger train 13 miles east of Kingman, Arizona. 116 people on board were injured, but no one died. In 1983, on August 7th, an unusual westward-moving cyclone crossed India to the Arabian Peninsula. Indian butterflies, never seen before, miraculously appeared a few days later in Abu Dhabi and Oman after being blown 625 miles by the storm. And it was on August 7th, 1990, that Nome, Alaska observed its ninth thunderstorm of the year. Now, that's not very remarkable in and of itself, unless you consider the fact that the number was more than the city had observed in the last 20 years combined. And in 1851, on August 8th, the Electric Telegraph Company of London produced a daily weather map using reports that had been received by telegraph. The map was sold to visitors at London's Great Expedition at Hyde Park. People paid one penny for a copy of the map. And on August 8, 2000, you've heard of it raining cats and dogs, I know, but fish? A rain of small fish fell on the seaport of Great Yarmouth, England after a thunderstorm passed. The unusual precipitation was probably caused by a waterspout that sucked up the hapless fish and deposited them on shore. And it was back on August 9, 1968, that a radar meteorologist accidentally discovered the concept of a rotating thunderstorm. You see, he was studying a storm near Marblehead, Massachusetts. The discovery would lead to the concept of the mesocyclone, a powerful rotating updraft in the center of some strong thunderstorms. Mesocyclones often develop into tornadoes. And on August 9, 2003, the temperature reached 100 degrees for the first time in history in Britain as Europe continued to bake in its worst heat wave ever. The mercury registered 100 Fahrenheit at Heathrow Airport to set the all-time record for the country. And if you're tired of all this summer heat, you can take heart because August 11th marks the official end of dog days. And finally, Friday the 13th in August 2004 will always be remembered for Hurricane Charley. The hurricane exploded into a Category 4 monster wind machine just before making landfall in southwest Florida. The towns of Punta Gorda and Port Charlotte were heavily damaged. Winds reached 145 miles per hour. That's this week in weather history.
Thank you very much, Bill Murray. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks here at Weather Brains, we have an email address you may use for that purpose. question@weatherbrains.com.
Who would want to do that, though?
Good point. I don't know. We do have a toll-free telephone number as well that you may use, 1-888-247-8627. That's 1-888-247-8627. For the Weather Brains crew, Brian Peters, James Spann, Kevin Selly, I'm David Black. Thank you for listening. Hope you can join us again next time. Weather Brains, copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Adios.
I think that's tasteless of you having a Coke float during the Weather Brains show.
That was unexpected. My wife, Colleen, brought that in while you guys were talking and put it on the desk, and I can't turn it down. Hey, that'd be rude.
But it's still not fair. How's that iPhone working, James?
This iPhone could be the coolest little doodad I've had in a long time.
What do you like the most?
Yes.
What do you like the most about it, James?
The fact that it just works just as easily as every application on my laptop. The screen is beautiful, it's easy to manipulate, and it's finally a phone where you can work email and the web, and you can do it easily and beautifully.
Yes.
I feel like I'm doing a commercial for Apple here.
Yeah, we'll have them as a sponsor next week.
Yeah, we'll send them an invoice for this.
Steve will say, weather who?
Maybe we should get Steve Jobs on.
That's the ticket. Talk about his products. All right.
Maybe he's a weather geek.
Could be. Hey, Kevin, pop an email to him, Kevin.
I'll get right on that.
All right. Enjoy it, guys.
Y'all stay cool.
Good day.
All right, guys.
Good day.
Thanks.
Bye.
See ya. Bye.